Terrific. Welcome back to the usability segments of Security and Human Behavior 2009. I am Casper Bowden of Microsoft, and I will be your ruthlessly strict chair for this session. When I hold up this sign, it means you have 3 minutes. This one means you have 1 minute. The clock will run continually at 10-minute intervals. So 1 minute before the last speaker, make sure if you have slides, you queue up your slides, and we will go with Andrew of the National Research Council of Canada.
Yeah, so my name is Andrew Patrick. Freelance scientist basically means as of Tuesday I'm unemployed.
Could we dim the lights a bit? Very
yeah.
Hard to read.
Oh yeah.
Who knows how to do that?
Today I want to talk about biometrics and human behavior associated with biometrics. With biometric systems, you really have two users, if you will. The user of the system, who's the operator of the system, the one who's purchased the system, who is using it to identify people, and the end user of the system, or the subject of the system, whose biometric information is being captured and used. And there are usability issues associated with both of those roles. And mostly I'm going to talk today about usability from the operator's point of view and problems that they have. Biometrics are continuing to be deployed in a wide variety of circumstances in what I want to argue is a very poorly thought out, if thought at all, collection of people who are going ahead and implementing biometrics without doing a lot of thought about what role it has and what where it's suitable and what it isn't. So passports, welfare systems, in jails and prisons to try to detect illegal immigrants so they can be deported instead of housed. Use in the airport screening, more and more in schools. There's a particular school that wants to take fingerprints of all pupils and staff, not too clear why. And here's another one using biometrics to tackle absenteeism. Seems like a funny way of tackling that problem. It's sad to report that Canada isn't immune to this. Canada in the last couple of days announced that is going to start collecting biometric information from all visitors coming into the country with no exclusions, so no exclusions for friendly southern neighbors. And it's also announced that it's going to begin to explore the possibility of doing iris recognition at a distance, on the move, for crowds at major events, such as the 2010 Olympics. There are a number of companies, about four or five of them now, who are selling such systems that can detect irises at a distance of 6 to 10 feet, usually used as people walk through a portal, like a gateway into a stadium, and captures things. So we're getting this more and more deployment about biometrics. And some organizations like Business Week are touting it as the dawning of an age. In this particular article, they're encouraging companies to get involved and make money. We're seeing biometrics being deployed in a wide variety of different contexts. And to the subjects of the biometrics, they all look very much the same. So the biometric that I'm offering to unlock my laptop or my cell phone or my USB key is the same biometric that's being captured by a border control agent to decide whether I'm going to get in or out of the country or not. In one place, in one characteristic, it's very casual. Biometrics are being used by things like Disney World to restrict ticket sharing, by gym memberships to make sure, again, that only people who have paid for the memberships can go in and out of the gym. At the same time, it's being used for forensics and so on. It can be very confusing about what the role is of those biometrics, who controls the biometrics, how they're being used, and so on. As actual operators of biometric systems, it actually turns out that it's not foolproof. It actually can be quite difficult. The U.S. Visit program, which is perhaps one of the largest programs that's collecting biometrics on a routine basis, this is the one that collects your fingerprints now, 10 fingerprints and face image as you come in and out of the U.S. or come into the U.S. and soon as you leave the U.S., unless you're one of the friendly neighbors. And this is data that's been analyzed by NIST, looking at the quality of the fingerprint images that are being captured by the U.S. visit system. And in this particular scale that they've come out of, the fingerprint image quality scale, lower is better. And you can see that for people over the age of 55, the quality starts getting quite poor. And qualities of 3, 4, and 5 are getting to be pretty unusual and pretty unusable, rather. So they're not having a lot of luck in collecting good, reliable data. Even taking photographs of people, you would think would be easy. Analysis of the US visit data is showing that the photographs that are being collected are not very good and not very usable in terms of being able to later recognize people. And so NIST is going ahead and developing proposals, for example, for overlays that would be used by the border guards in order to help them acquire better faces. The other thing is that although we're deploying these biometric systems very rapidly in a wide variety of contexts, our understanding of these systems, our understanding of the implications of these systems is not very good. This was actually a survey of computer science students in Miami who were asked about their interest and knowledge about biometrics, and they virtually have none. So even the students that we're training, who are the ones who are going to be hired by these agencies in order to run these systems, don't know much about biometrics. And so we're not marrying our deployment of biometrics with their training about biometrics and our research about biometrics. They're, from a subject point of view, if they have a choice, there are drivers about biometric acceptance. From the subject's point of view, the perceived usefulness, the ease of use, and the trust in the service provider really should be there if you want to get a willing subject. And yet a lot of those things are missing and are being ignored. Here's some data that showed that people's attitudes towards the use of biometrics varies a great deal depending on the context in which it's being described. So identification of arrested people was considered to be the most suitable application, but using it to rent a vehicle, like a car, was considered to be the least acceptable. And what it shows is that people's acceptability of biometrics is very much governed by the context. And yet we're using the same biometrics in a variety of different contexts without much thought. And then finally, one of the last things that is obvious is that a lot of biometric information, particularly fingerprints, is not secret. You're leaving your fingerprints all around the room this time, and yet we're using that same information, which can be very easily lifted from tabletops and shared and published. This is a particular example of the publication of a fingerprint that was lifted from a German minister and published in a magazine, complete with being published on a piece of film so that it could be easily used to put into fingerprint readers. Done as a bit of a stunt. I'd like to argue that one of the things that we should be doing in fighting back about this proliferation of use of biometrics, which really shouldn't be considered to be secrets, is publish our fingerprints. Just make them out there so that they become useless for any kind of identification or anything else. Because we're publishing them anyway, and people can be lifting fingerprints off your tabletops now anyway. Here's a quotation talking about the relationship between technology and sociology. So many people consider this to be a scientific or technical question, but it's more than that. We must have an integrated long-term system, sound science, etc. This could be very much talking about biometrics and the use of biometrics and the public policy about biometrics. This one happened to be about nuclear waste. And what are we doing about the whole issue about nuclear waste and the nuclear power industry? What I'd like to argue is there's a parallel. The nuclear power industry went ahead and developed nuclear power stations and a nuclear industry without solving some of the fundamental problems. Problems that everyone knew that was there, but problems that people were willing to overlook to get things done. And so we have this fundamental storage problem. We have short-term storage where most used nuclear materials are being stored in the power plants or nearby. And we can't agree on a long-term solution of what we should be doing about nuclear storage, and so we haven't addressed the fundamental problem, even though it's been a fundamental problem for years and years. I'm afraid we're going to be faced with the same thing with biometrics. We're going ahead and going ahead without addressing these fundamental problems. I'm done.
Andrew, while he's setting up, people are publishing their fingerprints on Flickr. If you search Flickr, people do artistic things with them and put them up there all the time.
Yeah.
we have 30 seconds. Andrew, would you say if you publish them, they're still useful for identification, right?
But they're not useful for things like plausible deniability.
So I'm Lee Church from University of Cambridge, and this is work done in collaboration with Alma Witten, John Anderson, Joe, and Frank Stiano. So it's looking at what does it mean to provide meaningful control over information? And arguably, control over technology and information is the meeting point of HCI and security. In some cases in computing, pretty much the only goal, the shared goal, I would propose. So, by looking at what happened, how we address this problem from the different perspectives of security in HCI, let's look at what kinds of things come out. So, HCI has changed in this slide into user-centered design. So I'm highlighting the fact that this is a particular way of designing technology that attempts to put the needs of the user at the core of the requirements analysis construction process. And if we look at the modern agendas for user-centered design, they come in a variety of forms. One of the things they stress is concretizing the users. So it's no longer the user, it's Joe, who we know this about, and who we believe is representative of a class of people. And it's no longer they are carrying out some tasks, it's they are sharing that image with these friends. Okay? The point of this concretization is so that we don't make accidental, casual assumptions about who our users are and what they can do. Another key thing that we have developed, that most of the usability progress we have got has been developed through, is direct manipulation. So instead of typing obscure commands into black and white text boxes, we now click on things and drag them. Operations directly on an object to do something. There is believed to be an economy of usability by many designers, so in order to make some things easier, we have to make some things harder. So the standard rhetoric is to make the things we do often, the things that might be done by inexperienced users, as easy as possible. And there is a process which I think I'll skip over given the time constraints. The SER cycle is essentially a discussion of how the process of doing this means that we have to take routine activities, give them names, abstractions, and embed them within our systems over time. If we look at how security has attempted to achieve its goals, then we can see a similar kind of thread going on. So Jonathan Zittrain's Future of the Internet argues substantially that the failure of security systems is resulting in people embedding the security decisions into the technology and allowing users at most to select between one or two of these options. This is, again, the desire for less interference drives this. Users are frustrated by an endless proliferation of dialogue boxes. And Alma's abstraction and feedback, again, properties. The failure of security usability design to address these has resulted in a culmination of embedding of rules. 3 minutes already?
Sorry, no, scrap that. You've had 3 minutes.
Thank you. So, the end result of this is a drive to what we're called appliancization, with a prize for anyone who can think a less ugly name. Which is the culmination of security behaviors and the behavior of what the system can do being embedded into a number of limited choices that the user can choose between. Now, so the usability people think this is a good idea, the security people think this is a good idea. But if we go back to what we were attempting to do when we set up the fields, we were attempting to give users control over their technology. Now, what we've done is given people control in the sense of you can choose between a set of opaque options determined by someone else. There are a number of problems with doing this. First, it's a pretty dubious form of control. If I have a different desire as to what the security behavior of my system should be, and all I can do is choose between a number of normative options, that doesn't get me very far. It's also a pretty dubious form of negotiation of what computers can be used for. So if we're going to follow this argument, then we have to imagine that when Wikipedia was set up, security professionals and usability professionals would have been happy with the idea of a system where random people can change random stuff on a website, and we'll use some woolly social process to deal with this. Because of this, it results in a need to predict what the system will be used for. We're taking the use and embedding these things as primitives within the system. That means we need to know what they are. So when we're designing a piece of technology, we need to imagine in advance everything we would want that piece of technology to do. We also need to be able to build rule descriptions that would be that would encompass everybody. So can we build, say, 5 or 6 set of rules that everyone on Facebook would be happy to use to define as their security behaviors? It seems kind of unlikely. It doesn't give us the ability to support a range of options. And it puts an awful lot of power in the hands of the technologist. The technologist is now defining exactly what technology can be used for, both from a usability perspective, what will be easy, and from a security perspective of enforcing it. Now, there are social problems with whether that means the right people are deciding what technology can be used for, and there are legal problems with companies being able to interfere after the fact to reprogram deployed technology. Zetran talks about the problems of perfect enforcement, people deleting user content after the fact, etc. And finally, there's the issue of user experience. We are now giving users an experience which says you can gain control over your information by selecting which one of these dictatorial authorities you would like to pick your rules from. So, what can we do about this? Well, there is a field of end-user engineering, which we're proposing as a way of building technologies that offer genuine, meaningful control, as opposed to this control by application. We believe that this addresses most of the things, essentially by addressing them head-on. If we view the act of configuring a security system as an act of programming, then we have to move away from direct manipulation. We can escape this economy of usability. We can make some things easier without making other things harder, we hope. We are very much supporting the argument of things like the future of the internet by putting the ability to generate new technology at the heart of the security configuration systems. The desire for less interference. Interference occurs because what's happening is the user is having to make decisions at the point they occur. They can't make decisions ahead of time. So should person X be able to see this file is a dialog box interfering with their work. Programming is the thing that allows us to make these decisions ahead of time and let them apply later. So we get away from dialog box hell. And we're directly addressing the problems as to how would we engineer abstraction and feedback. So, moving fairly quickly on. The case study to look at, as an initial step in this direction, is the Facebook user interface. This is the direct manipulation user interface. And on its own, it looks kind of reasonable. It's designed by a professional designer, except that there are 86 of these. And that's even before you start customizing the individual blocks of information as opposed to just the macro blocks of information. Now, so this means that in order to create the user experience we're giving somebody, is somebody has to make vast numbers of these decisions, these one-at-a-time decisions, in order to get a sense of control over their information. And the policy is not representable. This fills a screen, and you have to do that n times for n configuration options. If we migrate towards a programming-like mode, which we are proposing to give to end users, then we can produce a system which is terse enough to define its rules within a text box, and we can provide tools that, to the program amongst us, these would read like equivalence class testing tools. These are the people who can see the same thing as this. And we get a plausible story as to why individual X can see item Y. And so if the user wishes to engage in a one-at-a-time activity, which is believed to be cognitively easier, then they still can do. Yep. So, the really positive indicator is that we built this tool and ran a very small user study. And halfway through the very small user study, the technically naive user readopted our security usability tools in order to support what is essentially a expression behavior of personality. So this kind of tool got used for something that its designers did not realize it could be used for. That's exactly the kind of result that we're looking for. There are a bunch of problems. They're in a paper to new security paradigms. If you email me personally, and if I stand back from that with any luck, he'll let me send you a copy. The overall proposal is that we should seek ways to leave the last mile of the user interface and the policy design to the users, rather than trying to do it all ourselves. Thank you.
On the nail. Thank you very much. I'm sorry to give you that. Sure. That was outstandingly punctual, despite my efforts to ruin it. So the next speaker we have is Diana Smetters of PARC.
So, I'm from the PARC, formerly known as Xerox. I'm an applied cryptographer who hangs out with HCI people and anthropologists. So, you know, blame me for all unusability in this talk. And the other thing I need to put as a disclaimer is that I'm from Ohio, which makes me an optimist. So, John will represent the pessimist category later in this panel. So I'm here to try to start some arguments. Basically, I think for any panel, one ought to have some contention or at least some discussion. And at least, if nothing else, I want to ask people some questions because I've all got you trapped here. And because I used to live in New York, I'm going to do it really fast. So the title of my talk is Meeting the User Halfway. This is what I think we ought to do to get a little bit more usability in our security systems. So here's the premise. I think we've had a lot of lovely studies over the last couple of years showing us that, in contrary to everyone's expectation, you can teach users. You can actually teach them. They learn things. They do stuff. They get better at doing security tasks. But we've also got a lot of studies that say you can't teach them very much. And you can't teach them very much, especially if it's ancillary to what their primary task actually is. So my conclusion from this, which I think I'm not the first person to have said this, is that you had better design what you're going to teach them. You had better not say, I'm going to design my same old security system according to whatever I thought a priori was a good security system, and then I'm going to simply start cramming stuff into the head of my users and hope that by the time I reach their threshold, you know, I've gotten the important stuff in. So instead, I'm going to say, basically, how do I design a system from the ground up using new technology, using old technology, that minimizes what they have to learn, that puts it in the context of their actual task and asks them questions they can actually reasonably answer, and maximizes the benefit that they get from doing so, preferably in terms that they actually care about, and not in the, I get a better score on my compliance rating, or people yell at me less, but I got my report done faster, and it had better stuff in it. So, you know, an example of the fact that people's tools do not give them the controls that they need. They don't actually let them do their actual tasks in a way that is both user-friendly and secure. I put these quotes up just because I like them. This is from an ethnographic study that I participated in a while ago, where we interviewed a bunch of people who tended to work on cross-organization, but work in ways that required cross-organization data sharing. This was a healthcare consultant who tended to go state to state and needed to get access to sensitive data. And the problems she had were twofold. One, that it took so long to get permissions that basically to get her job done before her contract ran out, people would give her the data sort of under the covers because she couldn't get it via the official access controls. So basically she can't get permissions, but she can dump huge amounts of data on flash drives that she can, in theory, lose. And the other one is that basically there's no way to share small amounts of data. I always wondered how people would lose laptops with like entire VA databases on them. And now I understand that because no one can take a little bit of data anywhere. They can basically say, you know, all right, we go through great amounts of process to determine that I'm authorized to access this data. And once it's in place, we've made this binary decision, and then they're going to mail a CD to some random address containing all of this vast amount of highly personal data. But anyway, here you have an example of a user who actually cares about security, would like to do things securely, but there is no way for her in any kind of reasonable way to simultaneously be secure and get her job done. And being a rational person, she chooses to get her job done and not get fired. So, what do I mean by meeting the user halfway? So what it's not. Not is taking something like cryptic URLs or digital certificates and saying, if I train them enough with cool enough games, I can teach them to analyze these things and hopefully defend themselves. And amazingly enough, it's amazing that you can teach them these things, but it's not to say that you should. And it's not the best is the enemy of the good security, which is a great quote that I attribute to Dan Geer, which is basically, we care so much about having the best security that we will put, you know, all security aside until we can get it. What it is basically saying, what models do we need for our security? What are the architectural changes we need? What are the underlying systems we need to make users' tasks easy while being secure? So what are the questions we should ask? Things like, what should the model for user accounts be in the home? You know, it's clearly not the same from time-sharing systems from the 1970s. What kind of access control do users want to use? You know, basically, of all the knobs and switches, you know, you want to give people control, but of all the myriad knobs and switches, you know, there are probably only a subset of them. You know, clearly, they want more than yes, no, but how much more? My two favorite are, you know, SSL trust models are, shall we say, not the best. How should websites authenticate themselves to users? Not how should we present it in the GUI, but, you know, how should trust paths work? And, you know, frankly, it's useful to be able to click on links in email. So instead of teaching users not to click, how do we make it safe for them to click again? Okay, why is this hard? A, you have no idea what users find difficult, or even what they want to do until you ask them. You know, first thing I learned is security professionals' intuitions about difficulty suck, including mine. You have to give up on what you would think would be good for them. Yes, you know they ought to be secure. Yes, you really know that what they're doing to get their job done is not the best thing for it, but they have to do it anyway. And you have to make it possible for them to do it in the most secure way possible. And most importantly, you have to give up on them admitting that you were right and they were wrong, and they will learn to do things the good way, which means that, you might have to get them to do things more securely without them knowing that they're doing it. And this is sort of the big question of my talk, because you can only do it a bit at a time. So you can fix a few things here and a few things there. We cannot make Microsoft Windows completely secure by tomorrow. And is that good enough? So basically, it's the question of, do you throw up your hands and say, I cannot make the fraud and economic models work so that people will actually fix everything? Is it good to do, is it useful to do little bits of things in the hopes that they start to get better? And the last one is that everybody else is conspiring against you, which is the source of my question later. So after the talk this morning, I wanted to give an example of a system that we built last year, which it tries to do, you know, one little take on this problem. And this is the question of what, you know, trusted favorites, which is what Jeffrey referred to. So we were arguing that basically what phishing really is a mismatch problem. The problem is that what's in her head of where she thinks she's going on the internet is not where she's going, right? And what can the browser do about this? The browser doesn't know what's in her head. The browser doesn't know where she intends to go. All the browser knows is, at best, she probably doesn't want to go any of the places that the browser knows are evil. You know, this is blacklists. So that's probably a pretty good model, but that doesn't help very much. You know, even better, the browser says, you know, I'll show you everything I know about this website, and hopefully some of that's enough to let you decide whether this is what you really want to go. This is security indicators and toolbars and all this kind of stuff, and that doesn't work very well. You know, the best one I've seen of that, I loved the green glowing cube this morning. I thought that was really, really nice. But the hard part is, how many banks have you got? So what do we do instead? We give the user a set of secure bookmarks. Basically, we identify websites by URLs and public keys. We whitelist the internet. So we say the only things that we believe make good secure bookmarks and just demonstrate well to the users where they go to can be collected in our collection of secure bookmarks. And we use them to control single-site browsers. Basically, don't put this in your regular browser. Your regular browser has to talk to everyone. That's what a browser does. So we'll take the user for high-security websites to a toolbar that says, you know, here's your list of high-value sites, your bank, PayPal, anything you care about, and we'll give you links in there that authenticate their targets. We'll protect them with digital signatures. The toolbar, in fact, enforce whatever whitelisting policy that your toolbar vendor decides that, you know, that you select from your toolbar. And they'll launch in protected browsers, think like Google Home. We did this. We built it. It was actually easy to build. This project was 2 weeks from idea to implementation to paper. It is not hard to do. And we ran a little user study, and we asked people if they liked it, and they liked it. So anyway, so this is an example of what you might do as architectural change. So in my last 2 minutes, here's my question. And this is another example of what's fundamentally flawed. So what should a user do when they see the certificate warning? They should continue to the website. Why? Not because they're evil, but because 50% or more than 50% of web service certificates on the internet are wrong. So the rational thing you should do when you see a certificate error is to ignore it, because it's almost overwhelmingly likely to be a false alarm. So, pick on them, but the problem is, as long as configuration errors, which is what they generally are common, any technology that requires users to respond to security indicators is doomed to fail, I will argue, because the number of actual attacks is so much less than the number of false alarms. So the only way you can make this thing better is by basically, you know, making this ratio more rational. So either you can increase the number of actual attacks, which is how we get people to run antivirus, or you can decrease the number of false alarms. So So here's the question I will end on, or almost end on. So can we make the denominator low enough so that users might be rationally asked to notice indicators? Can we? You know, what would we do? I think we can improve dramatically usability for developers and administrators. You know, I could make the SSL certificate enrollment process a lot better. If we did, would it matter? I think it was Stuart who was arguing this morning that it doesn't matter, no matter how, you know, noticeable you make things, one carefully crafted email will appeal to people's intrinsic social nature and kill you. So my other premise is that this might be a good time to throw the baby out with the bathwater. When I started doing usability, it was all, it must run on Windows, you can't change Windows, and Windows is broken, so we're toast. But people are changing more stuff now. You know, people are buying netbooks, which are running Ubuntu, and you know, the users of those just don't care what the OS is. They care that it's usable. And if it happened to be secure, they wouldn't complain.
We're out of time.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Dee. And the next speaker is Rob Reeder of Microsoft.
Okay, so I'm Rob Reeder. Earlier, Stuart talked about some of the problems with using secret questions as last resort authentication, so I'm up here to talk about one possible solution, which is social authentication. So this is joint work with Stuart and Sarah Jagelman. The basic idea is that we could use people that you know, so trustees, who can actually authenticate you in person and then tell a web service where you've lost your password that you actually are you and you are looking for your password. And now I actually need slides. So.
And it's asking for you to
just typing your password wrong.
My password is.
It literally was asking for.
You're welcome to put the slides on my laptop if you want.
Just chop it up, slides.
This is Vista. We might have. The idea is that you could, as a web service, if you have a web service and you're interested in using our kind of last resort authentication, which is social authentication, you may provide the names of several of your friends and family who serve as trustees for you on your website. When you've actually lost your password, you can then contact those trustees, have them go to our recovery site and say that you've lost your password. Since the server at that point won't know that it's actually one of your trustees who's contacted them, the server will send the trustee an email to authenticate the trustee with a code in it that authenticates the trustee to the recovery service. When the trustee follows that email back, they will have been authenticated to the server. At that point, the recovery service knows that the trustee who the trustee is, but doesn't necessarily know that the trustee has authenticated the account holder in person. So they'll ask account holder several questions to guide them to properly verify that they've actually are dealing with the true account holder in real life. Once they've satisfactorily answered those questions, the trustee will get a code, which is then sent to the account holder. And once the account holder, the account holder has one of the codes that they need. The system can be configured so that you can specify any number of trustees and require any threshold K of the trustees to actually authenticate. So once the account holder has done this once for one trustee, they can do it for the remaining K of the trustees that they require. And when they have K codes, they can actually get back into the system. So the sort of secret sauce here is that in person, we're pretty close. In person, the trustee will have talked with the account holder in person on the phone, so they'll actually know that they're talking to the real account holder and not some impersonator.
Rob, if I want to show Chairman's mercy here, would you prefer to get the slides going in some of
this
case?
Protocol is really hard to describe.
Yeah,
illustration.
Yeah. Do you want to like pick up your time after another speaker?
That would be great. If
okay,
else.
All right.
Is there anyone who doesn't use slides?
John?
I'm not using slides, so.
Okay, sorry about this, but John, it'd be great if you could take over and,
yes.
And do yours. Thanks.
All right, so we'll pause. Well, Diana and I agreed that she was going to be the optimist and I'm going to be the pessimist, so I think I'll start off by quoting James Branch Cabell, who said that an optimist thinks this is the best of all possible worlds, and the pessimist is deathly afraid that the optimist is right. And that's kind of where we disagree on things. I've been working for the last few years on some of the very same sorts of problems where I was describing what I call the security cliff, which is that you must climb the cliff to get to perfect security and you can't stop anywhere in the middle, and it becomes much easier to stay at the bottom than it is to go to the top. And I thought, how do we make a security ramp? And also, as somebody who is a security person who is at least honest about his security, if you get a bunch of security people together over some beers after a while, you will start getting confessions about how bad their passwords are. And so how do we construct a ramp? How do we go up the security? And how do we get policies that do things and people don't? This has a number of obvious problems with it. If you have the security being done completely for people and it goes away, they will not understand it, and they can't because it's all part of the system. On the other hand, they aren't going to understand much of it anyway, so you might as well have something like a few dictatorial changes because they can't effectively, I mean, I don't think I could effectively create a security policy that I would follow. And this is actually turning out to be quite useful, and it works quite well. It gets used in organizations mostly for whom it works well because what the organization wants is to be able to do things like, say, everybody's disks and laptops will be encrypted because they contain huge databases, and if they get lost, dot, 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 dot. It includes, we want all of the email to be encrypted, and we'll take the time to describe a complex policy, and then it just gets executed. And this works extraordinarily well. It even works with really interesting, naive users. I have been helping set up my uncle to use my computer system where I'm using one of my servers, and my server literally passes the my 70-something-year-old parents can use it because my 70-something-year-old parents do use it, and it, you know, it's callus.org. And my uncle, who I was using it, is an incredibly smart person. He's an aerospace engineer. He worked until he was in his 80s. The canonical film of a Saturn V launch where there's the little ring that tumbles away. Everybody's seen this, you'll be nodding, oh yes, I remember that. He was the project leader for that ring. And yet he describes the rectangles on the screen. I mean, he does, you know, the word window is not part of his vocabulary, and the way that I and my father make things work with him is that we do screen sharing. You know, we share screens and then we set things up and we make them work and then it works just fine. So, you know, you do need to have a certain amount of dictatorial control in a lot of places. And I was recently asked the question that was then re-asked to several people, including just last week when I was listening to a talk that Bruce gave, which was, why doesn't everybody use encrypted email? And the answer that I gave before was pretty much a result of last year's conference on human behavior and thinking about psychology and economics and so on and so forth. And the problem is that the real risks of having unencrypted email are relatively small. They're hard to describe. We don't estimate these things very well. You know, we think that airplanes are unsafe and that cars aren't. We don't see that these things are available, are happening very often. You know, a decade ago, I was considered a weird person by saying lots of personal information is being lost when people lose backup tapes and da 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 da. We know this is happening even though we can't see the process of it. And it wasn't until laws and things were in place that we even started being able to detect these. Well, I started thinking about seatbelt use. I mean, When you look at wearing a seatbelt, the risks are actually pretty easy to describe. You get into a wreck and your face goes through the windshield. There are any number of high-profile cases. Princess Diana died because she wasn't wearing a seatbelt. You know, Jane Mansfield, you can go down the line of people who died in car wrecks, and it basically boiled down to they weren't describing seatbelts. And yet, uniformly, even today, in the few places where there are not laws requiring seatbelt use, left to themselves, people will wear seatbelts in the rate of about 17 to 20%. Even where I am in California, on the days when there wasn't a small child being kidnapped and thus the Amber Alert signs are useful, it says click it or ticket on it. There's warnings, fines, and so on for people to use something where there is a clear and apparent risk of death and dismemberment. So why the heck are they going to encrypt their email? Why are they going to do this if they can't get it through their heads that they should be wearing a seatbelt? And then, you know, this is the depressing thing. That, I mean, I agree, you can teach them, but you can't teach them much. So I think that it falls back to, we are going to have systems that start enforcing things for the users. We can, in fact, use, quote, libertarian paternalism, choices of defaults, and so on, to get people to move in the correct way. I'll bet that we could probably invert that 20%, so you'd have 80% doing it right. Again, depressingly, that might still not get rid of things like botnets, but it would handle an awful lot of other threats. We could probably get rid of phishing by constructing things in a certain way so that the defaults made phishing impractical because it would tip the economics around doing spam and phishing and so on, where it requires there to be large numbers of them. But I am depressingly becoming of the opinion that we are going to have to start making decisions for people because it's apparent from other spheres in human behavior that it doesn't work otherwise.
Okay, with that very punchy contribution, I think we can give Rob back his 10 minutes. Thank you. And I didn't introduce John Callis of PGP before. John.
Okay, so Stuart talked earlier about the problem. I'm going to talk about social authentication, and hopefully this time when I walk through the protocol, it'll make a little more sense from the slides. So let's say we have a Hotmail user, somewhat disgruntled. He's interested in using social authentication. We'll ask him, who would you like your trustees to be? So who will Bill pick? Probably not those guys, actually. Okay, that's more like it. So Bill specifies who his trustees are going to be and then goes on and happily uses email for a while until one day he forgets his password and has to contact his trustees to try to get back into his account. So let's say he'll start with Warren, who will serve as the trustee in our example. He'll tell Warren, hey, Warren, I forgot my password. Can you help me recover it? At that point, Warren goes to the recovery service and says, Bill's forgotten his password. I'm trying to help him out. The recovery service doesn't actually know that this is Warren yet, so it has to authenticate him. It'll do that by sending an email to the account that Bill put on the file when Bill signed up with the trustees. The email will contain a link in it, which Warren will send back to the service. And now the service knows that...
We just fished Warren.
What's that?
We just fished Warren.
Right. Presumably we know that we're talking to Warren. But what the service doesn't know yet is that Warren was actually talking with Bill, so it'll ask him a series of questions that will help him verify that it actually was Bill who was requesting access to his account. I'll get to those questions later on in the talk, but for now, let's suppose he answers them satisfactorily. The recovery service sends a code back to Warren, and Warren sends that code to Bill, and now Bill has one of the, as I was explaining earlier, K, potentially, codes that he needs to get back into his account. Okay. So let's talk about some threats to this scheme. Brain here will serve as our attacker. The first threat is that the attacker could directly intercept the account recovery code. So here, Brain is taking Bill's role and is actually asking Warren to initiate the recovery process. So Warren is going to go and do the recovery process, send the code back to Brain, and Brain has got one of the codes that he needs to attack Bill's account. So I'm going to talk about mitigations to each of these attacks here. So this is the set of questions that Warren needs to answer when he has authenticated himself to the server, but the server's still not sure that Warren is actually talking with Bill. So you see here is the possible ways that Bill may have contacted Warren listed, with the riskiest ones at the top. So if it's someone else who's saying they're helping Bill Gates, or if Bill sent an email or an IM to Warren, these are ways an attacker would likely contact the trustee to find out, and if Warren chooses one of those options, he'll be given this warning about a high scam risk. Now, one really interesting part of this warning is that it actually, we were able to show some of the common characteristics of what an attack looks like. So this is a nice way of messaging
We've been talking a lot in this workshop about how attackers can exploit user behavior. This is a case of where we can try to exploit attacker behavior. So we can actually message to users, give them signs of common attacks. And this can be updated dynamically to be consistent with the most recent attacks that we've been seeing. So let's suppose, though, that Warren chooses one of the other options. What we want him to say is that he's either speaking to Bill by phone or speaking to him in person. And if he chooses one of those, we won't show the warning about high scam risk. To give it a little extra level of assurance that Warren's not just clicking through this question really mindlessly, we actually make him swear to this legalish sounding statement that he's actually answering the question about how he's contacted Bill accurately. Okay, so the second way that this scheme can be attacked is that Brain can actually get the authentication email from Warren. So the way this attack will work is that Brain contacts the server. So he initiates the recovery process. Warren then gets an email that he doesn't know the origin of or why he is receiving it, but Brain helpfully tells Warren, hey, it's Bill. Go ahead and just forward me that email that you just got, and I'll take care of it all. And then Brain will have the code authenticating him as Warren to the recovery service, and the recovery service can then give the code to Brain. So to prevent, to mitigate this kind of an attack, we have several indicators in the email that get sent to Warren about what he should do or not do with it. So first of all, we say that it's for him only. We tell him not to forward it to anyone. We point out that he also shouldn't just forward the link to anyone, including Bill Gates. And in case he's really confused and wants to know what to do, we give him a hint at the bottom that he can actually report this as an attack. Okay, so we did three different experiments to investigate the usability and the security of this protocol. First was experiment one was just the legitimate use case. So we had people configure trustees and then ask them to initiate recovery sequences. And you can read the paper for all the details on this, but essentially of 19 trustees who attempted to recover their password, 17 of the 19 were able to obtain enough codes to authenticate. And we configured the system so that everybody specified 4 trustees and needed 3 to authenticate. So that's an 89% success rate, which we consider to be pretty good. The other two experiments involve the actual attack cases. So in the first case, we tested security against an email-based attack. This is the kind of automated attack that we see, for example, with phishing scams and so forth. So what we did here was create an email that would be sent out to trustees. Notice this is from Bill Gates 1, so not the real Bill Gates, but it almost looks like Bill Gates. And because we were going to design the email ourselves, but we kind of wanted our system to work, we actually enlisted the help of Dan Kaminsky, a well-known hacker, to help us design the email from the attacker perspective so that we wouldn't bias the study in our own favor. The way the experiment worked was we had 15 participants come to the lab. They would list several people who they felt they would use as trustees if they were really using this system. They then created a new Hotmail address that looked like it might be their Hotmail address, but didn't correspond to the actual account they were protecting. And then they sent an email to their trustees from that newly created address that would have looked indistinguishable from a scam. So it actually was a legitimate email, but So from the trustees' perspective, they don't know they're participating in a study. As far as they know, this is the real system. So this, we believe the study has a good ecological validity. And in experiment two, the email-based attack, 4 of 89 trustees fell for the attack. So that's a 4% success rate. And remember that the attacker would need to get K different codes so by raising K, we can actually lower the success rate down to quite low, like below 1% for the email-based attack. So we thought that was pretty good. So in our second attack scenario, we looked at targeted attacks. So what about attackers who know the victim quite well and may use a higher fidelity mechanism to place greater pressure on trustees? So we used phone-based attacks. In this study, participants came to our lab in pairs. Again, we had participants list the trustees that they would potentially use. And then we had each partner call their partner's trustees. So we were concerned that by asking people to let their trustees be called by someone and attacked in a study, that people might be not so willing to do this. So we set up a methodology in which we incentivized both partners to allow their trustees to be called and to help their partner attack their trustees so that everybody made more money if they initiated a call, and if the call succeeded, they made even more. So this is a nice example for those of you doing user studies of how you can motivate some of your participants to act as attackers to some extent. So we had 9 total pairs of partners, and this is what the results look like. When calling trustees, we had a 45% success rate. So this was not quite as good as the email-based case. Of those trustees who didn't allow themselves to be attacked in this case, 12% said they were unwilling, but another 43% said they were unable or confused. We think that may actually mean they were unwilling, but were socially awkward to tell the attacker who was calling them that they were unwilling to cooperate. So to wrap up, social authentication is time consuming. Actually, I didn't mention this part, but it took people as long as up to a day to authenticate. Although in the fast cases, it was less than 40 minutes, so it can be reasonable. It's highly resistant to the email-based attacks, and that attack rate can be pushed down even farther. Now, it was not so resistant to highly personalized and phone-based attacks, but we note that we don't really know any systems yet that are highly resistant to such personalized attacks from the ex-spouse or the close friend. And we think that although the attack rate now is something like 56%, it might be improved through trustee education and experience, and we're looking at other ways to improve the situation there. So that's all I have on that. I think I'm running my time.
Lori Freiner, who needs no introduction.
I'm going to talk about warnings, and this actually ties in pretty well with what Diana was talking about earlier. Let's look at some hazards. This is the sidewalk in front of my house a few years ago. The city of Pittsburgh informed me it was a hazardous situation. What should we do about it? Well, of course, the right thing is to fix the hazard, which is what I eventually did. The next best thing is we could guard against the hazard. My kids were willing to help out there. And if that fails, we could just warn people about the hazard. And of course, this is a mock-up, but I did find people in my neighborhood were doing that. This is kind of what happens in computer security as well. All too often, instead of actually fixing or guarding against hazards, we just warn people and hope that they do the right thing. But as it turns out that very often, as Diana pointed out, it's not really a hazard. So we all get used to just swatting away the warnings and nothing bad actually happens. But every once in a while, there really is something hazardous there. And of course, it's a problem because none of us are expecting it. So this is a typical warning with SSL certificates. Users see it, they usually ignore it. Why do they ignore it? Well, this is how they read it. Something happened and you need to click OK to get on with doing things.
I would so click on Technocrat.
All right, so this is what most of us think when we see these things. Okay, so we've been looking in our lab, what do we do about all of this? We came up with a process of looking at secure systems and trying to figure out how can we analyze them for the human threats to the secure systems. And so first I'm going to show you it generically and then how we apply it to warnings. So to start with, when we have our secure system, we need to think about what are the tasks that we're actually asking humans to do. And really identify those. Once we've done that, it's a good idea to look at each of these tasks and say, do I really need a human to do this, or is this something that perhaps I could automate? Once I figure out what I can't automate, then we need to figure out where a human might fail. And we have a human in the loop framework, which there's a whole paper on you can read. I don't have time to talk about it today, but it talks about all the places that humans might fail in these systems. And then we try to figure out if we can mitigate those failures, and then we loop and see, well, maybe we can automate some more. Right, so if we look at something like an SSL warning, the task identification is we're asking the human to determine whether the task I'm trying to complete is really dangerous. That's basically what we're asking them to do. And given the current warnings that we have, basically the human has no tools to help them actually make this decision in any sort of reasonable way. And so you could look at the situation like this. We have something, our web browser has determined that there is something that might be a little bit wrong here. A certificate is expired, something is a little bit out of whack here, it might be dangerous, and the user must decide because, you know, the software developer certainly isn't going to offer them any clues. What we would like to do instead is to use some sort of automated analysis to try to narrow the space. Okay? We want it to look more like this, so that there are some clues that might tell us that actually there's a very high probability that there really is an attacker here, there really is some danger. And in that case, our best bet is probably to really just block the user and not let them do whatever it was they were trying to do. And also through automated analysis, we should be able to detect that this is one of these run-of-the-mill, the, you know, certificate expired, there's really nothing actually wrong here, let's not bother the user at all. And we have a smaller gray area in the middle where we really need the user's input to help us figure out what's going on here. And so once we have that, now we want to focus on supporting the user's decision so that when they're in this hopefully very small gray area, they have something to go on to help them figure out what's going on. And so here we want to actually try to improve the warnings. And so here's an example. A bad warning might have the question, your web browser thinks this is a phishing website, do you want to go there anyway? Well, yeah, I think so. I want to go there, yeah. Okay. Better question is, you were trying to go to evilsite.com, do you really want to go there or would you rather go to yourbank.com? Okay. This is more to the point of what the user is trying to do.
I want
to
go to evil.
All right. So this is the theory. This is a user study that I did with Sarah Zugelman, who's been very popular here today, and Josh Sunshine and a bunch of other students at Carnegie Mellon. We tested this with 5 different warnings, 3 actual browser warnings, 2 that we made up. We had 20 participants per condition, so 100 participants in our user study. They came to our lab. We gave them each a series of tasks, one of which was to log into their online bank account, one of which was to find a book in the Carnegie Mellon library. And then there were some tasks that we didn't really care about. We simulated a man-in-the-middle attack to trigger certificate warnings. We couldn't do a real one because our university lawyers had a, well, they weren't happy about it. So we did this, and then we did an exit survey. So real quick, the conditions, we looked at IE7, which is a familiar warning, easy to override. We looked at Firefox 2, also familiar, easy to override. Firefox 3, less familiar, and it's actually very difficult to override. And then we had our own 2 warnings. One was a single page warning, which we designed to try to clearly convey risk, or as clear as we could figure out how to do convey risk. And then the second one was a multi-page warning, which starts by asking a question to determine how risky it is, and only goes on to give you the second warning if we think there's really risk. So these are the IE7, Firefox 2 warnings. This is the Firefox 3 warning. So you can see if you want to override this warning, you have to click on that little blue link at the bottom that says, or you can add an exception. And then you get this other thing, and you have to figure out that you have to click again on add an exception. And then you have to go here and figure out what to do, and it turns out you have to click on get certificate. And then you have to click on confirm security exception, and then it lets you through. So you, if you can figure that out, then you can override it. Otherwise, you can't. And so, let's see, then this is one of the ones that we made up. And so notice we made ours red so it would kind of stand out. And it says here, your connection to the library is either being intercepted by another party or someone is impersonating the CMU library. An attacker is attempting to steal information that you are sending to the library. We advise you to contact this company by telephone or using a different computer that does not yield this warning. Okay, so this was how we attempted to convey what the risk actually was. And then in our multi-page warning, we asked the question, the website responding to your request failed to provide verifiable identification. What type of website are you trying to reach? Bank, online store, other, I don't know. Okay, so that was what we did. So here are very briefly the results. The paper will be presented at USENIX Security in August, and we'll have it available soon. But basically, what we found is that Firefox 2 and IE 7, it didn't matter if they were at the bank or the library, everybody ignored those warnings. Firefox 3, again, it didn't matter where you were. Everybody tried to ignore them. Only half the people were able to figure out how to override them. The other half tried but couldn't figure it out. For our warnings, what we found is that at the library, people pretty intelligently said, you know, there doesn't really seem to be any risk here when I'm going to the library because I'm not giving them any information, so I'm going to override these warnings. But at the bank, people said, hey, wait, this is my online bank account, think something's risky here, I should pay attention. So that was good. But the bad news is that only about half the people actually paid attention. So 50% of the people, had this not been a simulated attack, would actually have given their online banking credentials to an attacker, which is really scary. And so our conclusion here is that, yes, there are a lot of things you can do to improve the warnings themselves, but really we need to think beyond warnings. And SSL certificates in particular, we need to think about protocols that don't rely on humans paying attention to warnings in order to protect themselves from attacks, that this is just not the way to go in the long term. All right, quick plug for Soups. Hope to see a lot of you there in Mountain View in July. And thank you very much.
Thank you all very much for keeping to time. So, questions?
I have one for Rob. By the way, Marcus Jacobson, Clark. Rob, I fear that people using your system would set themselves as the trustee. So I have a couple of email accounts, right, and I would designate myself.
You can already do that? Like, for example, in Hotmail, you can say, specify an alternate email address. That would be a much better way of using that mechanism than trying to specify yourself as a trustee, which is just an indirect way of doing it.
But did you test how willing people are to designate themselves?
How willing they are to designate themselves?
Or how unwilling they are to not designate themselves.
Right. I think what we envision in the future, and this is what Stuart alluded to when he talked about our Soups paper, is that there will actually be many different ways of many different backup authentication mechanisms that you can use in any kind of combination. Uh-huh. So we think that using your own alternate email is a perfectly good way of perfectly good backup authentication mechanism. So if you want to do that, you're welcome to do that and potentially also use trustees. What we envision too is that people will have different valued online accounts. So, you know, my junk email account, I don't really care if I lose access to it or if it gets compromised, but if it's my health vault account, I'm probably a lot more concerned and may want to really be careful about what kind of backup authentication options I use, in which case, and if I have a high value account, I'm likely to choose trustees who are legitimate trustees and not just me, because I know that that's a more secure scheme. Right? And to naive users who don't know any better, then they won't use trustees, and that's fine.
Okay, so I was just thinking because of the delay that you incur.
The scheme takes a long time to. Right. So that is the drawback, and for people who can't suffer the amount of time that it takes to authenticate that way, they'll have to choose a different mechanism.
Okay. Thanks.
Great question.
And if you could just give your name, because we're probably still getting to know each other. Peter.
I have a possibly whimsical comment. Peter Neumann again. for Diana, the French literal translation that you used for Descartes is that the better is the enemy of the good. And that by iteration, by the associative property of the comparison, would imply that the very bad is the enemy of the worst. And what we really have today is very bad. So I wonder, always when somebody throws that quote out, we're looking for things that are good enough. But what is good enough? When we're talking about human users who really don't understand most of what's going on underneath them, nothing is really very good. All of the alternatives are pretty horrible.
I think the question is, can we climb up the goodness scale rather than climbing down?
I understand the point very, very clearly.
Yeah, but you know, this is we want to move up from the bottom of the security cliff. I mean, that's why one reason why I picked the cliff metaphor when I was describing the same thing is that we do want to encourage people that they want to get to the top of it and recognize that we have self-imposed through saying, ah, but here's the problem with that, that we're deciding to stay at the bottom.
The world really isn't that bad. I mean, the number of people who do unprecedented numbers of things with technology that we would never have imagined were possible, and yet the number of people who actually get hurt by computers on the internet on a regular basis is sufficiently small that it makes newspaper stories. So life isn't that bad at all, and if we fear too much, then the response will be to turn computers into bricks that do nothing.
It's Chris next.
Yeah, so I have a response to Luke. I'm Chris Sulayan at the Berkman Center. So I think it's important to look at some of the issues that you presented in different industries, right? So
Okay. The
banks would like people to have better security, and it's not really in their best interest for people to have poor security and to get duped by phishing scams.
Right.
Facebook and these online advertisers, on the other hand, have a vested interest in making sure that users are not able to to navigate these interfaces, right? So, I mean, Ross has a great quote in his security engineering book, which is that Facebook has a strategy of dumping all the really hard security decisions on the users so they can respond to criticism by blaming the user for not turning off features X and Y. And
right.
I think in the instance that you're, in the example that you portrayed, Facebook gets a benefit out of having the user go through 68 different privacy options. And I don't know if usability enhancements are going to fix that solution when the company has an incentive to keep things difficult.
So, yeah, this is an oft-fielded criticism. With all due respect to Ross, I'm not sure I agree with him. There are two issues. First of all, it's kind of harsh to criticize a company for moral failing or for failing that we are perceiving as being bad on a regular basis when we haven't produced an alternative that we have proven they are not using. And most security professionals I've worked with will tell me that an access control list editor that can be used by naive end users, it's not a solution they can just reach for and give you. So we have to give Facebook the possibility that they would do it if they could and they don't know how. And it is taking usability researchers time to build systems that are still exhibiting usability difficulties. So this is not a trivial problem that we're accusing them of avoiding. So that's the first response. The second response is that it doesn't seem to me that that's going to be viable in the long term. If it really is true that these companies make most of their money out of privacy violations, which is vaguely what's being suggested, then over time, as the privacy violations mount, people may well opt with their feet. So even in the early growth stages, they may not have needed these systems, but towards the later end, as the adoption grows, etc., we may see the use of these systems being deployed. And after all, if you're the first social network that gives people a real experience of control over their information, that seems like a business case that would win. So you could be right, we don't know, but we should give them the benefit of the doubt before suggesting this. I think...
Yeah, John Mueller, Iowa State, following up on that, basically, John, I'm basically at the bottom of the cliff. I'll probably stay there. I have a perfect defense against anybody reading my email, namely that before they found anything of interest, they died of boredom. and basically, doing anything that encrypts it basically does me no good, costs me some money or something, some effort. So the question is, why is it so important to do that? I think I'm probably the vast majority of people. Obviously, if you're a government agency or you're trying to hire business secrets from another business and so forth, it'd be important. But why not just let the market decide? People who think they need it would get it, and others won't.
I don't think I would disagree with you on that. On the one hand, I will say that there have been studies done where you go to somebody and you say, well, are there any secrets on your cell phone? And this came out when there were essentially some vulnerabilities that allowed people to rummage through a cell phone over Bluetooth. People would insist that they didn't have anything of value on their cell phone, when in fact they would have the unlock codes for the place that they worked, if they were an office manager, or this, that, the other thing, and that when you look through the stuff that you will find of, oh yeah, I actually do have something. But yes, indeed, I mean, you know, what I have done is in fact that I'm creating systems that work for people who find them valuable. And if there is a criticism in what I'm doing, it's that I'm pretty much ignoring the people who don't find them valuable. And it's the people in the middle where it is, say, a solo lone individual who says, I need this and I don't have some things, that I'm not addressing them very well at all. We've been doing a lot with encrypted laptops, for example, and we have ways to recover encrypted laptops. There's a threat that is that if you go to various places and go through customs, that you may end up with your laptop scanned for espionage purposes. There are countries where they will do things like come into your hotel and copy your disk looking for things. And I was at one conference where somebody...
I'll let them do it free. And,
yeah. Well, you know, I said myself, you know, that you know, there was the NSA can crack certain keys for $10 million, and my response to that was, for $1 million, I'll give it to you. So you know, and I'll get annotation for a second one. But people who are off on their own are somewhat left behind, and I know this is something that I'm not doing very well. And if you aren't in that spot, then obviously I'm not providing any value to you. But there are lots of people who are in this, and I would argue that if we had constructed email in such a way that it was secure by default and the same password that you used to log in handled all of the security so that it wasn't in your face, or you had learned to do the extra thing up front, we would go that way. It's the defaults issue that we're really looking at. And the default is that we've never had it be secure, and it's thus consequently okay for us.
Jean.
I find it fascinating that we're sitting here in 2009 and believing that the happy market libertarian flying homie is going to solve this problem. But I don't think that is something we can, you know, come to closure on.
There is no problem.
If the happy pony doesn't solve it, it's not a problem.
I'm despairing. I'm saying that it's never going to get solved because there are, and that it's only going to be solved by ramming it down people's throats with legislation, etc.
You are not
then
the
it becomes
that.
Okay.
John and Luke both are like, well, the market, you know, the market.
Sorry, what?
The market will decide privacy. So I would just like to discount that and say it's certainly, we won't resolve the question and it's not provable. And the second thing that's not provable, you really surprised me because you said, it's not that bad. And I realized, I don't know how bad it is. I have, for example, although I am from the South, never lived in a place where organized crime had the money and the externally invested resources to control the area and do whatever they want. So I don't think we can certainly say, look, for us, it's not, hey, if you solved all these problems, I wouldn't get any grants. It's great. You know, I love my life. But I think that it could be that bad. And one of the problems with this is we don't understand how bad it is. And we don't know how much money is going, you know, I mean, it's there are guesses about the drug wars. There are guesses about extortion. There's guesses about spam. I think one of the more difficult problems is that we don't know how bad it is, and we're only just now starting to look at this as a macro problem. I mean, what are the big system problems that result from everybody failing to have usable security? And I think that is a huge open problem, and I don't even know how to answer it or begin
right.
to answer it.
So I totally agree that we don't really know how bad the problem is. So I guess My nervousness is not about saying this problem is solved, we shouldn't be thinking about it. My nervousness is about trading future uses of technology against a problem that we don't know how bad it is. We shouldn't close off things that we could do with computers until we know that we need to.
It was Ross next, and then David. Sorry, then Andrew, then David.
The comment I was about to make is no longer relevant to this discussion, David.
Sorry, it's Andrew.
Question for a number of you. I mean, it ties in very much with what Luke's been saying. With questions such as whitelisting, I want to look at this as a different sort of attacker for a moment, taking Bruce's approach of, you know, looking at different sorts of attacks, different sorts of defenders. If you start having this whitelist concept, how long before the RIAA starts trying to ram that down people's throats as a way to defeat peer-to-peer file sharing? How long before the big banks start using that as a mechanism to stop people entering the market? We've got to be very careful about anything which is a command and control oriented structure, which puts a restriction on who can access an open communications platform, because we run the risk of putting it into a closed communications platform. And that's what we had the option of closed communications platform, AOL, Genie, etc. The internet went out in that because it was open, because it was generative. How do we prevent that? I'm not saying you can't, but how do you feel we can prevent these sorts of whitelists being captured by those sorts of organizations?
So my answer to that would be, I mean, in some sense, we have a whitelist today. The whitelist today is the people who bought in early and put their keys in the browser starting in IE4. You know, that's the whitelist, and whoever they've sold their keys to. You know, and you get a little bit, finally, you can update root keys in browsers, so you know, it's a little bit less like it, but that's the whitelist, and it's become this kind of very, very messy, messy, messy whitelist. So you know, the system we built, the advantage of it is you pick your whitelist provider. You know, so it's the consumer choosing who they decide they want to have approve their stuff for them. So you always have that danger of, you know, basically whitelist providers that have their own economic motives and their own badness, which is how we get one of the reasons we have problems today. But the advantage is if there are the opportunity for a plethora of whitelist providers, you can vote with your feet. And we don't have that right now because there is a model that there will be one.
I was going to say that the dangers that you're talking about are in fact, I think, real. But we also are dealing with things like that about 40% of all malware now is signed code. I mean, you know, they're getting these things. I know people who have gotten spam messages for phishing with green bar EV certificates that the holes in the system are going, and one of the problems is that a solution that is, oh, you're going to have to pay some money to and prove that you're a real company to get these fancy certificates is that works really well until you get there. And if we succeeded in our education to get people to only use those, we would end up with a catastrophic failure because there would be no defense. It's, you know, it's very similar to the sort of security failure where carjackings were caused by car alarms. Car alarms caused a lot of casual car theft to go down, and so what that ends up with is that you are left then only with the people who are sufficiently desperate enough for a car that they will go to you, the running car with a gun, and say get out or just shoot you. So you know, and this is something that is relatively well documented, that the rise of car alarms brought us carjacking.
I'm thinking about what we heard here, because technically the session was about usability. And at one point, when we were talking about the analog with seatbelts, I found myself saying it's not hard to put a seatbelt on, and if you need a lesson, take a plane. And
my passengers would be stupefied these highly tasty to put seatbelts on.
Yeah, well, so the other thing I kept hearing in the session was, you know, well, we can't teach the user much, and we can teach them a little bit. And then there's this other question in my mind of, well, when is it their job to listen to the user? And maybe these people on the average who don't put their seatbelts on would say that maybe they're happier. And yeah, every once in a while they're filled with great remorse, but averaging across all the people, maybe they're happy. You know, you could also save lives by not skiing. So I'm struggling with what the lesson actually was here. Clearly there's a component of this that's usability. I wondered if it was sort of was, I think there's three threads in here. There's listening to the user, teaching the user, usability, moral hazards, or something. I don't know.
The one I was trying to get at was basically is, you know, embrace architectural change. And it was that basically if you make the underlying system more effective for the user, it's easier to make it, you know, make the user not fight with it. So you have a choice of multiple ways of making your system more secure. Pick the ones that work better for the user.
So my argument was that usability is about allowing people to do things with technology and making it easy for them to do so.
Alan.
So I want to go back to the whitelist questions for a moment, because two comments. First, in a small universe of very specific things, we can build a fairly good whitelist. List of banks. In the United States, there are a lot of people that can say whether or not you're a bank. And spend a lot of time sort of producing this list. But a general whitelist introduced all sorts of perverse incentives. And in fact, we had Trustee, which is from there. There's probably a common consensus on the value of Trustee in the room. And in fact, we have empirical data that if you take an average site on the internet, which is an average site from Trustee, it is more likely to be contained malware if it has a Trustee seal than if it doesn't have one. It's a great paper by Ben Engelbert a few years ago. Yeah. Showed that.
But that's also, I mean, any sort of certification is going to have that, where it's far more important if you are unqualified to have certification than if you are qualified.
Also keep in mind that the kind of whitelisting we're talking about in the system here is a whitelisting that says, you know, this is a collection of data that represents well where it will take you. So for example, I'm going to have somebody look at the logo, which is what it presents to the user, and say, that actually communicates to the user effectively the company on the other end of the web server, you know, who owns the private key. So you know, I'm going to throw out the one that goes to, you know, evil.ru that has the Bank of America logo on it. But the one that says evil.ru that has the little demon, yeah, that's fine. You know. So it's what the whitelist is saying. You know, it's not saying whether it's good or bad. It's just saying basically, you know, it's communicating to the user effectively where they're going to go.
That it properly represents itself.
Okay.
You know, it's more, is the label, is the list of ingredients accurate? Not are those approved ingredients?
Jeffrey. Jeffrey.
I was going to change topic.
Okay, anyone got any quick intervention on this subject?
Just very quickly.
Okay, we've got three, very, one sentence, Adam, and then.
Why are we confident that our understanding of what a whitelist contains and the user's understanding will be any good?
Well, it depends on whether we've talked to the users.
I would say that what we're doing is so bad that we might as well try it. when you know you're in a hole, stop digging.
And let the users pick a whitelist that works for them, or at least works for their friends.
Okay, quickly on this topic, Ross and then Frank.
Here's a quick suggestion, an idea I had while listening to you, Dan. You were saying that we should use a different browser with a whitelist. Now, a browser with a whitelist is a completely different animal. But if what this session is about is reducing transaction costs so that we can fix some security economics problems, here's a gadget that you could build. Cause it to exist a gadget such that when you put it next to your PC, it becomes a whitelisted browser. So when you put your mobile phone within a foot of your PC, you can only go to your bank. You can't go to a bank you've never banked with before. Mm-hmm. How's that as a usability hack?
Except if you've got My Desk and you forget that your phone is right next to your PC and you can't.
That's increasing the transaction.
Yeah. But other than that.
I'm fine.
You know, at first cut, I like it.
And Frank, did you help?
Yes. So there was this this picture you put up of the little girl that wanted to go to something. And do you want to go to a phishing website or do you not want? I said, I don't give a fuck about free. I don't know what it means. So if you want to go to Europe,
sound like
you're do you want to go to Eurobank or to eagle.com? The difference is that when you're starting making the real name of the site, the Eagle site, is not going to be called eaglesite.com. It's going to be called name of the bank dot something in the middle to confuse you.com, which looks the same to someone of average level of sophistication as yourbank.com, because your bank is also not called yourbank.com. It's probably called yourbanksecureinblah blah blah blah.com, blah blah blah. So how can you tell the difference between those two things if you start saying, oh, we can't say phishing because they don't understand phishing. Let's just put the real names of the website. They're probably even more confused.
Well, so I think if you put both names up there, then at least the user will stop and go, do I want to go to bankofamerica.com or Bank of America? Wait, what's the difference between the two? At least they're going to have to stop and think about it.
Lori, you should look at the domain name stuff.
And
think you should look at the domain names for Citibank. They have some fantastic domain names.
Well, so there is the issue that, we need the financial industry to stop relying on third-party providers and showing those to users in ways that confuse them, whatever. So I was not suggesting that this was a be-all and end-all solution, but more of a thought-provoking. If we did something more along these lines, it would be more useful.
On the other hand, if you reduce it to a 50-50 chance, that meets the best of what anybody's doing right now.
Okay, Jeff has been waiting a while.
Yeah, actually, when I saw the Rory, I don't even talk about the gray area in the middle, where you either just block because it's really bad, or you don't even bother people if the risk is very low in the gray area. And you basically were making this big pitch for, going to protocols, reading fewer warnings, and things of that nature. That's all wonderful. I did have a specific question. In your guidance that you were giving your test subjects about what to do, one of them was to contact, I think, a site or something like that. Did you provide any kind of instruction of what they should do when they do that? And did anybody do it?
So the only thing we gave them was what you saw. One thing I forgot to tell you about our protocol is that people were given a list of tasks they had to complete, and they were given an alternate task for each one, and they were told, if you run into any difficulties, stop doing this task and do the alternate one. So for the library, we gave them the phone number, and we said, call the librarian. And for the bank, we gave them the phone number for the online banking for their bank as well.
And did anybody make those calls?
Yes, so all of the people who we indicated did not... the people who heeded the warning, what they did is they switched to the other mechanism and they actually made the calls instead of that. What we saw, it was like, two people for the IE7 Firefox ones, about half the people for Firefox 3, and about half the people in the bank situation for a warning.
Yeah. I ask this because we always strive for looking for actionable guidance. I was curious just how actionable it was. It sounds like people actually did take the advice.
Yeah, well, but it wasn't so much because the advice was in the warning, but because the advice in the user study was, if you run into difficulties, do this other task. So I don't think this demonstrates that they would actually follow the advice in the warning, unfortunately.
Did you want to come in, Diana?
I think you can do it. Yeah, so if you're in the real world and don't have the phone number right in front of you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I don't think.
I would construct my fake bank with a customer service line.
Well, you have to get the phone number for the fake bank customer service line.
Get it from the website.
That's in the email.
It's in the email.
Yeah, I'll send you, yes.
Right. And in fact, some fishers are now doing the phishing banks, yeah.
So was there anything interesting in the exit interviews as to why they did?
Yeah, there was. We actually did ask them a lot to understand where the breakdowns were occurring. And what we saw was that with the early warnings, Firefox 2 and IE7, a lot of people didn't even perceive there to be any risk.
It's rough. Okay.
Whereas the risk communication was better in the newer warnings, and at least people understood that there was something risky. They understood why they might have wanted to pay attention. There was some difference in the communication.
So Joseph has been patiently waiting. And then Jeffrey, I think last question.
Right. I actually wanted to get back to the debate that was happening about this suggestion that in the social networking space, the operator is actually intentionally frustrating usability. There seems to be sort of a dichotomy between your position and Ross's and Luke's, who's saying that they want no usability and they do want usability, they just don't know how to achieve it. So I'll plug my paper I just wrote, which is in Weiss. We signed up for 40 sites and actually documented things. Two key findings for this argument. The idea that a site that had really good privacy would use that as a selling point, I think we debunked. There have been a couple of social networks that have tried to say it will be really private, and they've spectacularly bombed. But I do think, like Luke mentioned, there's a lot of evidence that they are trying to do stuff with privacy. They add features all the time, and some of them are specifically usability features. I don't think it's that they have an incentive for you to get confused because they need to violate your privacy, but they do want to steer as many people as they can toward having an open profile. Not because they want your data, but because the service is a lot more useful for everybody's data is open. Because then as soon as you sign on, you can see all of your friends' photos, and it's easy and fast. It doesn't require any configuration. So I think the issue is that it's not that they have incentives to get people to do the wrong thing. They have nudges to get people to do nothing.
Would
Want to comment on that?
Right, I mean, the defaults are always open, and they hide the privacy settings in the corner. Once you get there, like Luke's saying, it's not that bad. The problem is that people don't even go there.
So that seems to me a fair comment, is that it's not just a question of the controls. We don't know how to build better controls. It's also a question of where you set the defaults, and that's
right.
A major decision.
And so there are, essentially, I would suggest that the use of social networks and their ilk is still under social negotiation as to what the purpose of these things are, what people will want to use them for. And it could be that what people want to use them for is this very open information sharing model. Neither of our users in the study wanted that. They wanted the ability to screen off information presentation to different people, and that was what one of them tried to co-opt the security technology to do. So it's not that, I agree, but we need to make sure that we leave the doors open for that negotiation as to what the platform will be used for, rather than either annoying people by criticizing them, failing to provide them with alternatives, or by building technology that prevents that negotiative process happening.
Laurie, very quick comment, and then Jeffrey, last question.
Yeah. So I agree that what your ideal is would be nice, and I'm actually doing research to try to do that as well. But I've heard people from Facebook actually state that they believe the desire of their user community is openness, and that's why people join Facebook,
right.
And that's why they set the defaults the way they set.
Things might change.
Okay, so just following up one last time on the gray area challenge, I would love to hear more dialogue around the use of trusted advisors or education as a way to mitigate some of that uncertainty, and what has worked, what hasn't worked, and where we're going there in terms of research.
I think we don't have a lot of good data on what works. We have a lot more data on things that haven't worked.
Plug another suggestion that we've submitted to Soups as to, and Joe's the author, the lead author on it, as to how if we did build these privacy policies, then because they are now a program, they are amenable to sharing, redevelopment, acquisition from experts. So you can say, I trust that guy, I'll use his policies and just tweak them a bit here. Because they're programs, we can do that sort of thing. So we have suggestions as to how to take it there.
I'm afraid we're out of time, so please thank the speakers for a great session. And thank you.
Very smooth.
Brutal. Thanks for the laptop, Luke.
Oh, no.
This thing just keeps hibernating on itself.